Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you, Jane, for that kind introduction. I'd also like to thank Bank SA for the invitation to speak in Adelaide today. It's a real pleasure for me to be able to be here. The topic that I'd like to talk about this afternoon is inflation. And this topic ties in very nicely with the main theme of Bank SA's quarterly bulletin, which I understand is being released today. First, I'll talk in some detail about the distinct cycle in underlying inflation that we've seen in Australia over the past 6 years or so. And after that, I want to discuss some of the lessons that we might take from this cycle, as well as some of the broader lessons that we've learned from the past 2 decades of inflation targeting in Australia. So I want to start with the cycle in underlying inflation that began in the mid-2000s, and that's clearly evident in this graph. As you can see, across a range of measures, this cycle has been the most pronounced since we started inflation targeting in the early 1990s. Between 2005 and September 2008, underlying inflation rose by more than 2 percentage points, from around 2.5% to just over 4.5%. And then since late 2008, underlying inflation has steadily declined, and over the year to March 2011 was around 2.25%. As the Reserve Bank discussed in its latest statement on monetary policy, this decline in underlying inflation looks now to have run its course, and a gradual rise is expected over the next couple of years. Given this, it's timely to look back and to review what caused this recent cycle and the lessons that it holds for our understanding of the inflation process. Before doing that, I think it's worth noting, though, that we don't see the same cycle in headline CPI inflation. And this largely reflects the quarter-to-quarter volatility in the prices of fuel and fruit and vegetables. And this volatility has been especially pronounced over the past 5 years, and it's partly because of the effects of cyclones Larry and Yasi on banana prices. So this volatility is one reason that we spend so much of our time looking at these measures of underlying inflation. At a general level, the fact that underlying inflation picked up between 2005 and 2008 and then subsequently declined is hardly surprising. In the period immediately prior to the North Atlantic financial crisis, global commodity prices were rising very strongly. The unemployment rate in Australia had fallen to its lowest level in more than 3 decades, and there was considerable capacity pressures in the economy. The result, not surprisingly, was a pickup in inflation. Then, when the slowdown occurred, pressures on capacity eased, global commodity prices fell, and again, not surprisingly, the result was a moderation in inflation. What did, however, surprise us somewhat was the amplitude and the timing of this cycle. Within the Reserve Bank, the staff run a number of standard workhorse models of inflation based on historical relationships. While these models all are consistent with a pickup and then moderation in inflation, they have difficulty explaining the amplitude of the recent cycle. And you can see this in this next chart, which shows the average fitted value of 4 of these models along with the trimmed mean measure of underlying inflation. In mid-2008, for example, underlying inflation was around 0.75 percentage point higher than can be explained by the average of these models, and none of the models can explain why underlying inflation reached over 4.5%. In contrast, during the period from 2005 to 2007, inflation was lower than could be explained by these models. The general picture that one gets from this work is that underlying inflation in Australia was slower to pick up than suggested by the historical relationships, but when it did eventually pick up, it did so more quickly and by a larger amount than suggested by these relationships. When we look closely at the details of the CPI, it's clear that this pattern is largely accounted for by the price of services. I think you can see this in this next chart, which shows the inflation rate for manufactured goods in the CPI separately from that for non-manufactured goods. As you can see, over the past decade, movements in the prices of manufactured goods are pretty well explained by import prices, the exchange rate and labour costs. In comparison, over this period, the historical relationships do less well in explaining the inflation rate for non-manufactured items, the models underpredicted inflation in the middle years of the decade and then later, sorry, the models overpredicted inflation in the middle years of the decade and then later underpredicted inflation. This overall pattern of surprisingly stable inflation for a few years and then a sharp pickup is also evident in the RBA's own inflation forecasts over this period. In late 2006 and early 2007, the outcomes for inflation were surprisingly well contained. And at the time, we and quite a few others wondered whether something fundamental had changed in the inflation process. But not long after that, the inflation outcomes were turning out to be considerably higher than we had expected. In fact, the difference between the RBA's 18-month ahead forecast for underlying inflation and the actual outcome over the year to September 2008 was the largest over the inflation targeting period. So in trying to understand this experience, there are three specific issues that I want to talk about. The first is the evolution of unit labour costs. The second is the impact of housing-related items on the CPI. And the third is the role of international factors. So first to unit labour costs, which is the average labour cost per unit of output. And in the long run, movements in unit labour costs have a critical bearing on the rate of inflation. Over the inflation targeting period, unit labour costs have increased at an average rate of 2.6%, and the CPI has increased at an average rate of 2.7%. The fact that these two numbers are so close to one another is no accident. For if the profit share is to remain relatively constant over time, average growth in unit labour costs need to be consistent with the inflation target. Of course, in the short run, the link between unit labour costs and inflation is not nearly as tight. As you can see from this chart, growth in unit labour costs picked up considerably in 2004 and remained high until late 2008. And the bottom panel of the graph makes it clear that this was the result of both faster growth in average labour costs and slower growth in labour productivity. Now, the pickup in labour costs in the middle years of the 2000s is evident in a wide range of measures. Not only was there a lift in annual wage increases as the labour market tightened, but there were reports of many firms upgrading positions in an effort to retain and attract staff, and the upgraded positions carried higher rates of pay. Many firms also increased the bonuses and the other benefits that they paid to their staff. And this increase in labour costs coincided with a period of slower growth in labour productivity. Since 2005, estimated labour productivity growth has averaged less than 0.5%, compared with average growth of 2% in the 1990s. The reasons for this slowdown are not fully understood, although it's partly the result of high commodity prices that have allowed lower quality and more costly mines to be developed. In any case, productivity growth will need to pick up again if our living standards are to improve at the rate that we have become accustomed to over the past two decades. I think this is a major challenge facing both the private and the public sectors over the years ahead. But looking back at the recent cycle inflation, it's clear that developments in unit labour costs had a significant role both in contributing to the increase in inflation and then to its decline. But they provide only a partial explanation, and alone they cannot explain why inflation picked up so sharply in 2007 after having been stable over the preceding few years. Now, one possible explanation for this pattern is that there's some threshold in capacity utilisation, which when crossed causes inflation to increase very quickly. An alternative explanation is the short-run dynamics of underlying inflation were influenced by other factors during this period. And it's difficult to formally test these two explanations, but these other factors do seem to have played a significant role And of these, it's developments in housing costs that are perhaps the most important. So I'd like to now touch on those. Currently, housing-related costs, which include rents, utilities and the cost of building new dwellings, account for around 20% of the CPI. That's the largest share of any single group in the CPI. As you can see here, the housing component of the CPI shows the same general pattern as that in underlying inflation, although the recent moderation in housing-related costs is less pronounced. There are a couple of factors that are important in explaining this general pattern. The first is that the large run-up in Australian house prices that was driven by the adjustment to low inflation ended in late 2003. When the housing boom came to an end, building cost inflation came down and growth in rents was subdued for a few years. And these outcomes helped hold down overall inflation rates during the middle years of the decade. But by 2007, the cycle had turned, building costs were rising more quickly, and growth in rents accelerated. And the faster growth in rents reflected the changing balance of demand and supply in the rental market, with strong population growth coinciding with relatively slow expansion of supply. The second factor is utility prices. During the middle years of the 2000s, these prices were increasing at an average rate of around 4% a year. And that was slightly lower than that in the previous years. Then from 2007, utility price inflation accelerated very sharply. The proximate cause of this was the regulatory decisions allowing double-digit price increases, partly to help fund infrastructure investment, particularly for the distribution of electricity. But a deeper cause was the low levels of investment in previous years, which meant that the capacity of the system to distribute electricity had not kept pace with growth in demand, particularly during the hot weather. While these developments in both rents and utilities help explain the particular dynamics of inflation over the recent cycle, they also demonstrate that when the economy is operating up against supply constraints, all sorts of prices, and not just the price of labour, start rising more quickly. The third issue that I want to touch on is the role of international factors. Looking at headline inflation rates across countries over recent years, there's a deal of similarity in the movements, and you can see this in this chart. Many countries in both Asia and the North Atlantic experienced increases in headline inflation rates in 2007 and 2008, and many experienced declines in late 2008 and in 2009. This co-movement partly reflects the large changes in global commodity prices that occurred over these years. When global oil prices went up, they boosted the CPI in almost every country, and when they went down during the financial crisis, they led to CPI inflation rates falling almost everywhere. And movements in global food prices over this period had a similar global effect. In terms of underlying inflation, we do see some co-movement across countries as well, although less than in headline inflation. When underlying inflation in Australia was rising, so too were the equivalent measures of underlying inflation in the United States, as were the exclusion-based measures of core inflation in most Asian countries. Similarly, measures of underlying inflation fell almost everywhere in the aftermath of the financial crisis, although there's been more dispersion in the past year or so. These common movements reflect the correlation in the business cycle across countries, as well as the flow-on effects of the large changes in global commodity prices to the prices of a wide range of final goods and services. Movements in the exchange rate have also had an important influence on inflation outcomes over recent years. Particularly, the trend appreciation of the Australian dollar from 2002 has helped hold down the prices of many imported manufactured goods. For example, the price index for household electrical appliances is 8% lower than it was 9 years ago. Over the same 9 years, clothing prices have fallen by 10%, the price of shoes by 13%, and the price of Manchester by 24%. These are all very large price declines over an extended period of time. But around this trend appreciation of the exchange rate, there have been significant swings. In particular, a large depreciation of the currency as a result of the financial crisis saw the prices of many manufactured goods increase in 2009, and these increases slowed the moderation in underlying inflation during this period. More recently, the subsequent appreciation of the currency has again led to quite large falls in the prices of many manufactured goods. I think in the CPI over the past year, the price of every manufactured good actually declined. Overall, though, these swings in the exchange rate have played a relatively minor role in explaining the recent cycle in underlying inflation, which has been primarily driven by domestic factors. So to summarise, an important lesson from this whole experience is that inflation responds to changing pressures on capacity in the economy. When demand is high relative to the economy's capacity to produce goods and services, the costs of labour and raw materials tend to rise, and firms' markups tend to increase. Conversely, when demand is low relative to the economy's capacity to produce goods and services, these pressures ease, and inflation tends to fall. It's also clear that the dynamics of the recent cycle were influenced by capacity pressures in the housing market and by developments in utilities prices. And they are also influenced by capacity pressures in the global markets for commodities. But these factors alone fall well short of fully explaining the cycle, with the upward pressure on prices in 2008 being very widespread. So you can see from this next chart, around three quarters of the 90 individual items in the CPI were increasing at faster than their average rate of the previous two decades in 2008. Similarly, the deceleration of inflation since September 2008 has been very widespread, with the prices of relatively few items currently increasing at faster than their average rates. Looking at the experience over the past 6 years as a whole, it's clear that the protracted period of above-average growth in unit labour costs did eventually lead to higher inflation, and this was compounded by a variety of other capacity pressures in the economy. And subsequently, the slowing in unit labour costs during the downturn and the easing of these other capacity pressures saw inflation moderate significantly. But if we look beyond just this recent cycle, I think the past 20 years carries a broader and a perhaps more important lesson. And that is, the economy works better with low and stable inflation, and the monetary policy framework matters. In the 1970s and the 1980s, we saw the consequences of high inflation. Inflation eroded the value of people's hard-earned savings. It made long-term planning more difficult. It added to uncertainty. It distorted investment decisions. And as the late 1980s showed, it made leveraged asset purchases an easier path to wealth than hard work. And the end result of all this was slower growth and greater economic volatility. Of course, high inflation also meant high interest rates. In the 1980s, the inflation rate averaged 8% and the mortgage rate averaged 13%, and as many of you will know, peaked at 17%. In contrast, since 1993, inflation has averaged just a little above 2.5% and the mortgage rate has averaged 7.5%. And the volatility of both inflation and interest rates has also been much lower under our current inflation targeting regime. I think the clear lesson here is that changes in the average inflation rate ultimately lead to changes in average interest rates, including those on mortgages. Today, most people take low inflation as a given, as a permanent part of our economic landscape. Inflation expectations are well anchored, and the possibility of a rapid increase in the general price level is not something that most people worry about. This is how it should be. There are enough uncertainties in today's world without adding uncertainty about the average rate of inflation to the list. Now, for all these reasons, there is broad community acceptance that the main contribution that the Reserve Bank of Australia can make to strong, sustainable growth in the Australian economy is to keep inflation low and stable. In concrete terms, our objective is to keep the average rate of inflation over time somewhere between 2 and 3%. We've achieved this over the past two decades, and this has been one of the key building blocks for Australia's economic success over this period. Importantly, from the start, we've had a flexible inflation targeting regime, focusing on medium-term outcomes, which is what ultimately matters to businesses and to households. And under this framework, inflation has been both below and above the 2 to 3% range. The framework allows us to respond to one-off events and to large changes in world relative prices in a way that promotes economic stability, and the framework has been important in anchoring inflation expectations. Looking ahead, as the bank has discussed recently, the current environment is a particularly challenging one. In the central scenario, we are looking at a significant boom in investment in the resources sector at a time when the overall economy has relatively little spare capacity. While conditions are very strong in parts of the economy, other parts are finding things very difficult because of either the high exchange rate or the ongoing restraint in household spending and borrowing. And to add to the complications, global commodity prices are undergoing a structural shift as hundreds of millions of people in Asia enter the global economy. It's not easy to navigate our way through this difficult environment. But the new realities of the global economy have improved Australia's medium-term prospects. At the same time, though, they are causing considerable structural change in the economy, and this is leading to difficulties in a number of areas. As Australia takes advantage of its new opportunities and manages this difficult process of structural change, the task for the Reserve Bank of Australia is to keep inflation low and stable. By doing this, we can help promote sustainable growth in jobs as well as economic and financial stability. Over the past 20 years, low inflation has been a key ingredient to Australia's economic success, and maintaining that record will help us meet the challenges that lie ahead. Thank you very much for listening, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions.
James Sexton here from Adelaide Hills. Just a question. With the real main control on inflation being the mortgage rate or the lending rate, which only affects a small section of the Australian market, quite often just mums and dads with their home loans, etc. Have they done any modelling at all with the Reserve Bank on using a GST variable to control inflation, which would affect those people that don't borrow money as well?
The short answer to that question is no, we have not. I mean, our instrument is the cash rate, and so that's what we're focused on. Other areas of the government may have looked at that, but at the Reserve Bank, it's not something we've looked at.
Dr. Lowe, Chris Russell from the Advertiser newspaper. It's sort of a really related question. You say that there's broad community acceptance of the bank's role in controlling inflation. But it's probably also true to say that when that results in interest rates going up, there's quite a broad community negative reaction to it. Is the bank able to, either on its own or in conjunction with government, try to look at more innovative ways of controlling inflation so that the pain is more targeted to those sectors that are causing the inflation rather than being a broad brush approach which hurts householders and small business?
Well, again, our instrument is the cash rate, so that's what we're responsible for. Of course, fiscal policy can play a role. The inflation is caused, as I talked about in my remarks, by an imbalance between demand in the economy and the economy's ability to produce goods and services. And so there are two margins one can work on here. One can work on controlling aggregate demand, and the instrument we have, I say, is the cash rate. There are other instruments in fiscal policy instruments as well. In the medium term, though, the real challenge is, I think, to address the supply side of the economy. How do we lift the rate of productivity growth in Australia? Again, this is not a core responsibility of the Reserve Bank, but productivity growth has been very low for the better part of a decade. As I said, if we can't lift the rate of productivity growth, then we'll have to get used to a lower rate of growth in our living standards than we've had for the past 20 years. So rather than the focus being on controlling demand in the economy, I think from a medium-term perspective, the real focus should be increasing supply.
Other questions? Just on this side down the back.
Nick Warden from Adelaide. I'd like you to comment, please, on the current crisis facing the European Union, and in particular the solvency of Greece in that scenario.
That's a very good question. Well, the situation's obviously very difficult and I would say quite fragile. Greece has two fundamental problems. One is its debt situation, with the debt-to-GDP ratio heading towards 150%. And the second is its lack of competitiveness. Over the past decade, its domestic cost structure has got very high and it's had a fundamental loss of competitiveness. And it needs to find ways to address that loss of competitiveness and to get its debt situation down. In the short term, it needs the support of its European partners and actually the whole global community providing additional funding. And the Greek public need to accept the restraint that has to take place there. If both those things don't work out, then there could be a disorderly resolution, and that would be bad for the world economy. I think we'd see a rise in risk aversion again sweep across the world, and that would be very difficult. So in the short term, the money needs to keep coming and the Greek people need to accept the restraint if there's going to be an orderly workout here. And if it was not an orderly workout, then I think it could be very difficult for us all.
Kevin Norton from online newspaper In Daily. Philip, there was a lot of criticism of the Reserve Bank in relation to last November's rate rise, in particular from the retail sector, saying that it had an almost immediate impact the following day on retail sales. I'd be interested in your understanding of the empirical evidence as to whether there were other factors at play in that retail downturn or whether you actually did see a correlation.
Well, I think that November rate rise did have a big effect because it was the 25 basis point rate rise from the Reserve Bank, and on top of that came an additional up to 20 basis points from the private mortgage lenders. So for many borrowers, there was a rate rise of 45 basis points, and I think that did have a very significant effect on people. More broadly, though, there's this structural change going on, I think, in the household sector. We had really for the better part of probably more than a decade, up to the mid-2000s, households spending every dollar that they got in extra income. And that was really the part of the adjustment to low inflation, to higher house prices, to liberalisation of the financial system. But I think that process probably finished around the mid-2000s. And since then, we've seen a more conservative household sector. It's particularly conservative at the moment, but this is not something that's just come out of the blue. It's been a trend, I think, building since the mid-2000s, with the households trying to get their balance sheets into a less risk-averse position, and the fact that the structural change is over. But it's clear at the moment that there is quite a deal of cautiousness out there. The interest rate increase you spoke about was one factor. The Greek situation is probably another. The high utility price inflation that I spoke about is probably another. And I think these things collectively are working to keep household spending quite subdued. It's difficult to know how long that's going to last. And as the bank has said on a number of occasions, I think you can tell plausible scenarios or develop plausible scenarios in which this continues, in which the households continue to spend only 70 cents out of every extra dollar they get. and that would be quite a restrained consumption environment. Alternatively, at some point, this may turn around and households say, well, we've done enough consolidation and we start spending a bit more out of our extra income. And at the moment, we're just really watching the data very carefully, trying to talk to as many people as we can to try and understand where this is likely to head.
Philip, Christine Locker. As employers, you'd have to be really concerned about labour costs increasing and productivity decreasing. I guess twofold question. Firstly, is it the fact that we're not innovative enough? I mean, is it a requirement for business process re-engineering? And secondly, how do we compare in productivity to our neighbours?
They're both very good questions, and I'm afraid my answers won't meet the quality of the question. I mean, it's very difficult to pinpoint what needs to be done to improve productivity. I mean, I wish I could give you a list of three things that we could kind of do straight away which would make a difference, but I can't. I mean, ultimately, productivity growth comes from the way that workers and their firms and their employees interact with one another. And the regulatory environment's obviously important there. The industrial relations laws are important. The skills that both the workers and the management have, the incentives to innovate in the system. None of these are kind of easy fix areas, but I think we need to keep the focus on those areas because we've enjoyed two decades of tremendous growth in our average living standards, and we're going to need to focus again on these areas to make sure that businesses and their workers find better and better way of doing things. In terms of productivity comparisons across countries, in most areas we actually rate pretty well. I mean, our living standards, which is ultimately driven by productivity, are very high by global standards. That we can often, in the constant round of negative news we see, we can often think that things aren't going so well here. But if you look around the world, what other country would you want to be in? I know, as a central banker, if I could choose which country, which central bank to work in, I think Australia would be the answer. We have the issues that we face are issues that are really coming from a very favourable medium-term outlook. In most other countries, they're dealing with problems that come from long-term structural issues or huge problems in the financial system. We don't have any of that. We're benefiting tremendously from a big change in world relative prices, from the development of Asia. And that's a source of tremendous support for the Australian economy. In the years ahead, we're going to have to go back, though, to making sure that the way that firms and workers interact is delivering ongoing growth in productivity, and it's not easy to do that.
I'm a little bit perplexed about one thing, more than one, but being of Greek background, I'm wondering how a country of 10 million people can create such havoc in the world economy. It's like me going broke and everybody in this room collapsing. And I just find it very, very difficult to believe that world markets are relying on Greek economy where there's only 10 million people. And one other question. Do you think that the Reserve Bank acts too quickly in terms of increasing rates and then is too shy to bring them back? Thank you.
Let me try and answer both of those. On how 10 million people in the Mediterranean can pose a risk to the world economy, if it was just Greece, I think it would be very hard to tell a convincing story how that could happen, but it's not just Greece. I think the fear here is that if Greece was to default and or leave the euro, there would be others that would follow. We know the list of countries here: Ireland, Portugal, potentially Spain. And if those countries collectively went down that same path, I think that would be the world economy would have a very difficult time. So it's because it's not just the 10 million people, it's the broader European or the southern part of the European economy. Hear. Yeah, everyone speaks around because that's where the action is at the moment. But the real fear, I think, in the policy community is if Greece was to go down this path, then other countries would... The market pressures could develop to a point where other countries felt like they had no choice but to go down that path, and I think that would be very disruptive. But if it was just Greece and fiscal policy, the debt situation in the rest of the world was sound, I'd agree with you. But unfortunately, that's not the situation we're in. In Europe, and I'd have to say the United States and Japan, we've seen long-term structural rises in public debt relative to GDP, and it's put many of those economies in a very difficult position, particularly the ones that have lost competitiveness or have very big ageing problems. And it's the general state of public finances around the world that's causing concern, and Greece is really the catalyst for those problems to come to centre stage. Has the Reserve Bank acted too quickly? Well, it won't surprise you. My answer to that is no. When the downturn came in October 2008, you might remember that we cut interest rates by 1 percentage point. And we hadn't, you know, the previous decade we'd moved in 0.25 percent points. So we were prepared to move very, very quickly. We moved before, I think, any other central bank in the world to move interest rates of that magnitude, and we followed that up with very large increases over the following few months. So we responded very, very quickly when we saw the world economy change. And then as things in Australia turned out better than most people had expected and than even hoped, then we thought the process of normalisation was appropriate. And if you look, as I said in my talk, if you look back over two decades, the inflation rate has averaged pretty much at the midpoint of the target, just fractionally above. I think if there was a persistent pattern of us having moved too quickly and then not having reduced quickly enough, we wouldn't see that. We'd see inflation averaging below the midpoint of the target, which it clearly is not. I think we're symmetric. When the shocks facing the economy are symmetric, but when the shocks are asymmetric, as they were in 2008, we are prepared to cut interest rates very, very quickly and by a large amount.
Philip. Harley Hooper. It seems to me that every day you open the Fin Review or another national periodical and all you hear about is that interest rates are going to rise, and this has been going on since January, I suppose, it's going to go up 0.25 percent next month and another 0.25 percent in August. Well, here we are, July, and it hasn't happened yet. But the every senior economist in Australia seems to feed off it and writes these articles about the reason for it is inflation. And, I mean, you talked about inflation in the 80s, which I think, you know, at 17%. To go back 30 years and talk about something that could be relevant now, I think is just ludicrous. But, you know, that was your call. But the question is that when will the Reserve Bank take a position? Because every time we read this another 0.5 percent increase, the whole small business economy goes on a bender. And they really take it, the confidence just goes completely out of the market, in every market, especially the building industry at the moment, manufacturing, et cetera, except the mining boom, and they don't care less what the rates are. But what I'd like you to address is, when is the Reserve Bank going to take a position so that we don't have to go through this, next month they're going up? I'm sick of it. And I think everyone in this room who are self-employed are the same.
Mm. Well, I understand the difficulty here. From our perspective, the central message that we've been trying to communicate for some months is that if our central scenario for the world economy and particularly for the domestic economy turns out to be correct, then interest rates will probably need to be higher at some point in the future. At some point. And the reason we've felt it important to communicate that to the public, when we're really speaking to the Australian people, not the financial markets when we're doing this, and the reason we felt it important is that when people are going and making borrowing and investment decisions, when they're making consumption or saving decisions, there's a public benefit in people understanding our broad thinking about what's likely to happen over the coming years. And so we're really trying to communicate that so that at the end of the day, people can make better informed decisions. It's not about our communication is about the medium term, so that people can make better decisions. And the financial markets obviously telescope that down right to the very next decision, and I think that's inevitable in our system. But really, our communication is really about the medium term. And if business investment rises 15% next year and another 15% the year after that, which is not too far from our central scenario, then our judgment has been that interest rates at some point will probably need to be higher in Australia, and people making decisions should understand that's how we feel. Of course, things rarely turn out exactly how you expected them to, and as in 2008, when things turned out different, we can change course very quickly. But at least with the central scenario, I think it's important that people understand the broad contours of interest rates that are likely to go with that. Even though I know from month to month it's incredibly frustrating and unsettling to some people.